good quote.
But you're not going to hear it tonight, I don't think. There it is.
You were lurking. It's by Aeschylus from the Orestia. In our sleep, pain, which we cannot forget, falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. Comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. What I watched with my stepmother, Phyllis, was that as the pain dropped by drop on her heart, and she kept saying, I don't understand this pain. It's like, I've been a good person. Why am I having this much pain? Why is it so hard to die? I watched that ego finally surrender and this spirit come forth, and the being that I was then with was like, it's like being in the presence of just pure grace. And her death was just absolutely just like ink going into water, just dissolving, just breathing out. And I saw this being who I had never expected to see in our lives together emerge, and I had to admit that it was the pain and the suffering that beat that ego down for this other thing to come through. And I knew I could never have done that to her. And it was the awful grace. It was the awful grace. And what I experience in myself now is that when I'm dealing with somebody, like somebody that just found they have AIDS, and my heart is breaking and we cry together, there's another part of me that is just seeing it all as the unfolding perfection of the universe. That's the new curriculum this person now has. Oh, they're going to learn a lot from this. And at some point they'll drop their body. It's interesting that as you extricate yourself from your identification with your separateness, your whole feeling about death changes. Because the part of you that isn't separate isn't coming and it isn't going, and there's no birth and there's no death, you just are. But because that part of you is not knowable by your mind keeps denying its existence. The part of you that is not in form is only beable, it's not knowable. And the mind goes up the wall trying to figure out how to control that part of you. And for us to stretch to handle what seems like a paradox to the mind, that it's all perfect and it's horrible. That there's nothing to do, really, so get on with it. That it is all empty. And when you embrace all of it, you start to embrace the human condition into yourself. You start to embrace the suffering. Like, if you live fully in this moment, does this moment include that baby that's taking its last breath from starvation? Yeah. So are you sad? Yes. Does it include the baby taking its first breath as it comes out of its mother's womb? And the joy of the beginning? Yes. So you're happy. If you are the fullness of the moment, all of it, these are all your voices. The cry, there's a beautiful... This won't be so hard to find. Beautiful poem by Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, among other things, I won't read the whole thing. He says, I am the mayfly metamorphizing on the surface of the river. I am also the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond. I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. I am also the merchant of arms selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. I am also the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up all the four oceans. Please call me by my correct names so that I can hear at the same time all my cries and all my laughs, so that I could see that my joy and pain are but one. Please call me by my correct names so that I could become awake, so that the door of my heart be left open, the door of compassion. If you and I are to be free, there is nothing we can push away. And when we die into all of it, and we get out of the egocentric predicament, I should have a better system, shouldn't I? I really feel like a slob. There it is. Next time I'll have it in a computer and I'll push a button and it'll print out. Gandhi, God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. Meaning you stop being so busy being you. And when a person thus loses herself, she immediately finds herself in the service of all that lives. It becomes her delight and recreation. She is a new person, never weary of spending herself in the service of God's creation. It's interesting that when you have extricated yourself from your own egocentric predicament, and when you have tasted the emptiness of all forms, then your action comes out of the collective quality of the situation. And the suffering of another person is something you do not because I'm helping you, but because it is healing itself. And you're not collecting points for it. You are merely tuning yourself to being part of the harmony of things. You're being part of the way of things. It's like you're dying into the perfection of it all, which includes the beauty of your mind, but it's the servant. It's available, but you are no longer trapped inside of it. It's just the subtlest flip in where you are in relation to who you are. Before you identified with the clouds, now you understand that you are the sky and the clouds. As you extricate yourself from your somebody-ness, from your thoughts, which are things, from your body, which is things or stuff, who you are has no time, has no space. It's not here, it's here. Hakuin, the Zen poet, says, your coming and going is nowhere but where you are. You're always right here. Where are you going to go? Ramana Maharshi was dying, the beautiful saint, and all his devotees were crying, don't leave us, don't leave us. And he said, don't be silly, where could I go? It's like I'm just selling the Ford. It's no big deal. With that quietness, comes a way of being in the universe. It's what Heinlein calls grokking. It's like you are part, you are one with it all. So that the action that you perform as a separate entity arises out of the collective wisdom of the situation, rather than doing it in an angular way, cut off from everything. You start to trust your intuitive heart. Very interesting to start to live that way. You don't have to figure it all out. You start to trust that place. It doesn't mean you're anti-intellectual. Your mind is a beautiful tool. It's wonderful. It's just not a trap. And under those conditions, you start to become responsive to the world around you rather than reactive. Because your mind is part of law. It's all cause and effect, and it's all reactive. The minute you're in that awareness behind it, you're free, and you hear it all, and out of it comes that which is suitable to bring things back into harmony. Let me read you this one story from How Can I Help?, this wonderful book by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman. It really is good. It's got a lot of good stories in it, and this is one of them. It's a story about, told to me by a friend of mine who's an Aikido master. His name is Terry Dobson. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty, a few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the dusty, at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore labor's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed this metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I had been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you're already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even crossed the street to avoid the pinball punks who lounged around the train station. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized the chance to focus his rage. Aha! He roared. A foreigner! You need a lesson in Japanese manners! I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insulin kiss. "All right," he hollered. "You're gonna get a lesson." He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, "Hey!" It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. "Hey!" I wheeled to my left, the drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman, sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here and talk to me, he motioned to the old man. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, "Why the hell should I talk to you?" The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. "I've been drinking sake, and it's none of your business." Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. "Oh, that's wonderful," the old man said. "Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every evening, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we take our bottle of warm sake and we go out and sit on the wooden bench. We watch to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My grandfather planted that tree. We've been very concerned after those ice storms we had last winter. But you know, it's done better than we expected, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. And we take our sake even when it rains." He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said, "I love persimmons too." His voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "Nah," replied the laborer, "my wife died." Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. "I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the door opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. "My, my," he said, "that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with love. I had just seen Aikido in combat. One more little brief thing, and then we're going to meditate together. As the mind quiets down, and there are a lot of practices to help you quiet the mind and to extricate yourself from identification with your thoughts, and you have more available to you that intuitive heart, that not the emotional quality, but it has a quality of presence and softness and the feeling of the depth of love. It's like the quality of Christ's love, that quality. It's a very interesting thing what starts to happen in your life and how you deal with it. Most of us grew up feeling like the ego is, in a way, got built on the idea that if we do the right things, we're lovable. I mean, we just grew up in an environment of conditional love. No matter how much our parents loved us, they still had an agenda. They had to socialize us. And they would tighten up if you, you know, shit in the living room floor. It's like they just tightened up a little bit, you know. And you learned how what you didn't do to make it work. And you ended up with these feelings inside that, and you end up looking to find somebody who will feel safe for you to open your heart around. And most of the time, your heart is armored, as I said. And then somebody comes along, and there's some concatenation of stimuli, some configuration, and it releases that place in you, and you experience the quality of being back in your intuitive heart again. And you say, I am in love. And then, because you've been so starved for that, and that the other person had the key which opened your door to that place, you say, I am in love with you. The other way of saying it is the other person is a stimulus which is a releasing, which releases the releasing mechanism which allows you to be in the place of love, and you are in love. And then, because you're so addicted to this state, you want to connect, you want to possess your connection, like any addict. So where will you be Tuesday night, and Friday night, and for the rest of our lives? And you get jealous if the connection services anybody else, because you really want to feel that quality of being in love. Now imagine if through these practices, something starts to change so that the veil of your mind is thinner and you actually are experiencing that quality of love more. Now you walk down the street and you look at somebody and you experience that you are in love with them. The old model you have of deprivation says, I better collect this person. Because you're used to not having love. You've been so starved. So you say, let's nest. And you get feathers and twigs and drapes, and you create a nest, and you get all cuddly. Do you love me? How much do you love me? Ooh, I love your eggs. Ooh, ooh, everything. Ooh, I love, ooh, ooh, wonderful. And then you go to the store for some tofu and beer, and you're at the checkout counter, and you look into the eyes of the person at the checkout counter, and it happens again, because it's in you, but you still have the deprivation model, but you got one in the nest. So what do? Some of you have faced that. Ménage à trois. Very complicated. It's beginning of tremendous economic, political, psychological, social problem. And then what are you going to do? Never look at anybody else? Maybe what you're going to have to do, and what I found myself having to do, was give up my deprivation model. Give up the model that I was starved for love, and that I needed to collect my lovers. And what has happened, and I can hardly understand it yet because it's still too new to me, is that everywhere I look, I'm beginning to see the beloved. And I love people so much, I don't know what to do about it. And I have to realize there's nothing to do about it, which is very bizarre, to look at somebody and love them that much and not do anything. I mean, you would want to wave or collect a phone number or just hi or something like that, but you know, you walk into the bank to cash a check, you look at the teller, and the teller is just the perfection of God as teller. I mean, it's absolutely essence, and you just but the minute you say, oh, Divine Mother, or you're beautiful, she presses the button. I mean, it's like you learn there's nothing to do about it. as you stand back a little bit, you see the beauty of the manifestation, each one uniquely. Even the stinkers are essence stinker. And your personality is saying no and cut it out and you can't do this and I won't allow this. And on the other part, you're totally in love with them. And then you begin to see the beloved, the guru, whatever you want to call that, everywhere you look. You just see it all the time. There's a Kabir. Since the day when I met with my Lord, there has been no end to the sport of our love. I see with eyes open and smile and behold his beauty everywhere. I utter his name, and whatever I see, it reminds me of him. Whatever I do, it becomes his worship. Wherever I go, I move round him. All I achieve is his service. When I lie down, I lie prostrate at his feet. Whether I rise or sit down, I can never forget him, for the rhythm of his music beats in my ears. Quiet mind, open heart. Not standing anywhere. If you're burning out in the human heart, go up. But if you go up and you lose your humanity, you lost part of it. Sure, your heart's breaking. That's okay. You bear the unbearable. That's what it means to be free. It means free to embrace it all, free to push nothing away. But it's all empty. It's all play or dance or forms within forms. Sufferings, life, death, all of it. The hardest thing I have to do in these lectures is to integrate the incredible depth of the pain of suffering with the nature of the cosmic giggle. Most people can't handle getting those two things together. I talked about it in Hawaii a few weeks ago, and an article came out in the paper, the headline, which I loved. It said, "Ex-drug guru says life a cosmic giggle."
Well, that's what happens to them.
Oh, it's too beautiful, all of it, all of it, all of it, all of it. And when you're not busy being attached, you then fulfill, you listen and you hear your unique way of manifesting in the earth. You hear your uniqueness. I have an 89-year-old father. My job is to help take care of him and make sure he's happy and taken care of and safe and protected. That's my unique karma. I'm an American. I have something to do about that. I have to make sure that this representative democracy gets a fair shake and gets kept in control. I'm part of an ecosystem. I have to make a statement about nuclear proliferation and but if I do it out of fear and urgency, all I'm doing is increasing the fear, which is the root cause of the bomb in the first place. When I take care of Dad, when I protest against the bomb, when I do all the things that I do every day, meet the airplane stewardess, do all the stuff I do every day. All of it is the stuff I use to work on myself in order to increase the equanimity and to increase the compassion. It all is exercise. Your entire life is curriculum. everything you've got right on your plate is where the stuff for your enlightenment is. It's breathtaking when you stand back and see the beauty of that design. And that includes all of it, death and sickness and dying and AIDS and all of it. We're going to meditate. I'd like to begin the meditation with a piece of music that just goes about 4 minutes. It's called The Miserere, and it's by Allegri. This music was inner court music in the Vatican, actually, and Mozart heard it, and he was so taken with it that he went home and copied it from memory, and made it available, but it's by somebody named Allegri. It's a Gregorian type of music. As you listen to it, use it as a meditation by going into the notes. Keep merging with the note. Now, other parts of your mind will be noticing your body. It might be tired or hot or cold or something. You might be hearing sounds around you. You might be noticing the beauty of the music. All that's fine, but just keep coming back into the note itself. Keep merging with the note itself. Keep coming in and in and in. And after about 3 or 4 minutes, I'll lead you through a short visualization meditation, and then we'll take an intermission. Hammy?
Thank you.
Now bring your awareness to the middle of your chest. Just breathing naturally. Just being with what is. Now, using your imagination, imagine that right in the middle of your chest, there sits a tiny being the size of a thumb. The qualities of this tiny being are that it is radiant, that it is intensely present, that it is boundlessly compassionate, that it is wisdom itself. This tiny being sitting in the middle of your chest. Now this tiny being begins to grow in size until its head fills your head, its arms your arms, its legs your legs, its torso your torso. You are a skin around this being of equanimity, of presence, of clarity, of caring, of peace. Now you and this being as one begin to grow in size larger and larger until your head breaks out of the top of this auditorium. You keep growing in size much larger and larger until your head is sitting among the planets, your body is sitting in space, and the entire earth is within your belly. It is part of your body. Feel your vastness, your silence, your presence, your equanimity. Now this, as you look down within, inside yourself, at the earth, at the mother, at Gaia, at this beautiful, precious earth, which nurtures and feeds, at the consciousness that is earth. And towards it you feel such tender compassion. And then you become aware of the myriad beings on the surface of the earth, on its land and waters, in the atmosphere above the earth and beneath the earth. Beneath the water. All these beings, each with its own agenda, each trying to survive, and you see at once the fear and the hope and the tenderness and the cruelty and the chaos and the order and the beginnings and the endings. And from your vantage point of vast equanimity, you understand it all because it's all part of yourself. And towards it all, you feel compassion. And then you continue to grow in size and until everything is within you. The galaxies are all part of you. Everything you can think about, past, present, and future, is part of your body. You are the Ancient One. Equanimous, wise, because all form is within you. You are love and truth, ultimate beauty, peace. You have no boundaries. You are both form and unformed. Swami Ram Tirtha, the beautiful Indian saint, describes this space. He said, I am without form, without limit. I am beyond space, beyond time. I am in everything. Everything is in me. Everywhere I am. Now let this vast one begin to reduce in size, passing through the stage where the earth is within the belly, coming down to the place where the head is above this auditorium. You are seated beneath the auditorium, and all of us are within your body. From this large form, look down inside yourself and find that tiny being whom you thought you were when you came here this evening. See that tiny being, and in a glance, see its life unfolding. See it as an awareness or a soul that is passing through a life of form. See it as a being that is learning its way back home. See the way now it comes up for air and sees through the veil of its separateness. And now it gets lost again. Feel your tender appreciation of its journey and of its deepest inner truth. And then add to the way you see that being all the rest of us, and then start to be aware that around this vast being that you are all other beings, tiny, stretching as far as the eye can see, all sentient beings all around you, and you are like a light, just like a presence, a beacon of equanimity, of truth, of peace, of blessing. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free. Now let this vast being reduce in size as it comes down to the size of your body in this room. The being separates and becomes smaller and smaller until it is the size of a thumb resting in your chest. This tiny being is wise. Though it is tiny, it contains the entire universe. This tiny being of compassion is your spiritual friend. This tiny being is your guide to guide you on your way home. As you learn to listen to your intuitive heart, this tiny being speaks to you from its infinite compassion, infinite mercy, infinite wisdom, infinite love. And when you have fully awakened to recognize who you are, you realize that you and this tiny being are one. Ollie and free. Okay, this is the question segment, and can we do something? And I feel that one of the most powerful aids that I've had in my spiritual work is surrounding myself with people with whom I have the contract to be straight and to be as truthful as we can be. Truth really is an incredible vehicle for helping to liberate. It's very scary, and most people don't really ask for it. And you've got to hear exactly what the nature of the contract is of what people are asking for, because a lot of people are asking just not to make their egos feel bad. But my friends, I've invited them to tell me when I'm losing it and when I get off, because we all lose it all the time, at least I do, and then I need my friends to help me know that I've lost it and bring me back. So I think that as you look around, you see, as you want to go on this journey more intensely, you really are turned towards friends that you invite to help you get straight. So I offer you my truth tonight. And I will answer any questions that you pose. I'll repeat them if they're too soft. Questions? Yes. How to help children grow into a meditative... develop spiritually, too. First of all, you've got to realize that that each stage of life has its own agenda, and that you've got to become somebody before you can become nobody. And that if you try to become nobody too soon, it gets very confusing. You don't develop the ground. So that kids have really got to learn how to wear their spacesuits before they can figure out how to take them off, okay? Otherwise it gets screwy. So. But what you can do is the work you do on yourself as a parent creates an environment where you allow the child to do what its agenda needs it to do. At the same moment, you don't reinforce its identity with its agenda, so that when it comes up for air, you're right there and you've always been there, and it recognizes those places. It's interesting when My mother died, and then I went to India, and I met my guru, and he told me how my mother died. All that's in Be Here Now, and it kind of blew my mind. And then the next day he said to me, your mother is a great saint. And I said, he said she was, didn't he? And he said, to the translator, and the translator said, no, he said she is. So I thought about that for a moment. And when he said that, a very interesting thing happened, because she had been a very good middle-class mother. She did it all just right. I mean, she really wanted her kids to turn out well, and she was really good at it. And the few times when she and I had ever transcended mother and childness, I could almost count on one hand. They were so rare, because most of the time we were in the role. She was very seriously a mother, and I was very seriously a child, right? But there were moments, like once when I was about 10 years old, I was coming back from the dentist with her in the car, and we were seeing who could hold a note the longest. We came to a red light, and we stopped, and a car pulled up next, and we both looked over, and there was this man looking at us as if we were insane, see? And at that moment, we transcended mother and childless. We were just two people caught, you know? And it's interesting that at the moment he said that, those moments, like one of them when she was dying, I was working with her at that point, those moments became figure, and all the rest of it, the way in which we had been mother and child, became ground. And that's never reversed since then. Since then, I've just seen her as a fellow being, right? And as you understand that you are just, that this is just another being who happens to be the child for you to do work with this time, that's the optimum thing you can do, without demanding the child have any spiritual forms too early. Forms are not wrong or right. They are appropriate to the uniqueness of the karma of the individual. And for some people, were they not to have a mate, they would spend most of their time being caught in not having a mate. For other people, having a mate, they will spend most of their time being caught in having a mate. And then there are others who will absolutely flow, I mean, so that you've got to listen, because some are, it is absolutely appropriate that they have a mate with whom they have a very continuous working relationship. And if, as I said before, if you have a blessing, you have a friend with whom you share the exploration of truth. And that can be a partner. See, once you start to be in love with people, then you hear what business you have with one person or another. One person you just shake hands with, one person you do nothing with, another person you may bear a child with, another person it all depends. You listen. There's no rule of the game about it, okay? So the way our individual unique predicament works out is, and you can't have a fixed model about how it'll always be, because it just is the way it is at the moment. Your commitment has to be to truth, not to consistency. A lot of marriages, the commitment is to consistency, and they're kind of like living dead. I mean, they're not living, they're kind of dead. So the commitment's got to be to truth, and truth is very scary. It's almost a little chaotic at times. A relationship that is really committed to truth walks the fine line between cosmos and chaos. Because after all, you and I are many different beings, and we keep meeting, and it's like a whole orchestra meeting itself all the time. Because there's all these different levels of reality that are meeting, all this different stuff. So it's an incredibly rich play of a relationship. Relationship yoga is the most exciting and the scariest yoga of all that I can see. Because it is, it's always right on the edge of chaos, if it's living truth. The minute you get too comfortable, beware. Sir?
As a whole, your eyes in that yoga, are we living in a relationship of love and chaos? Are we living that yoga right now?
In relation to the planet?
Yes.
Well, I'd say that the planet itself is, for its side, its living truth. Our side is a lot of trippiness of our minds about it. And I don't know how often we are really in a true beloved relationship with the planet. I think very often we get caught in our minds because we're afraid of the intensity and the immensity of the presence of the planet. So I'm not sure we do really have that full truth going with the planet all the time. It would be nice if we did. Yes. Yeah, it's an exquisite paradox. Her question is, if suffering is grace, what am I doing out there trying to change it as a helper? And the interesting thing is, when you stand back and you see the way in which the suffering works, you see how it's all unfolding lawfully. What is also unfolding lawfully is your human heart, which is feeling the pain and wants to help get rid of the suffering. And if you deny that, that's denying part of the universe too. That's the paradox, that we are both separate entities that will do what we can to relieve suffering. That's part of the perfection of it, that occurs, as well as having the deeper wisdom that sees why it is all there. And you live with that paradox all the time. Maybe when you are completely free, you are in the position where you can impose suffering for grace. But I'm not in that position. I've got to still honor, and I expect to continue to honor, that part of my human heart that will constantly work to relieve suffering. Then it's interesting, but what you do is you listen to really hear what suffering people want relieved. And you stop trying to take away suffering people aren't asking to get rid of. It's very interesting. I mean, the cute example I have is somebody comes in to me and they say, you're a hatha yogi, which I used to be. Would you please, I'd like to fast. Fine, I say, fast for 9 days. Well, I'd only plan 4. No, do 9. It's good for you. You can take lukewarm water. Yeah. You can tell people anything, you know. So around the 7th day, they come up and they say, I haven't eaten in 7 days. And you say, great, you're doing fine. 2 more days and you'll be enlightened. They give a little ego boost. Then you walk outside and somebody comes up to you and says, hey, man, you got a quarter. God, I haven't eaten in 7 days. Great, you're doing fine. 2 more days and you'll be enlightened. You see, can you feel the inappropriateness of the same situation? And what you end up doing is you listen from moment to moment to hear what suffering people are able to work with and what suffering they're really asking to have taken away. And you listen because your human heart wants to take away suffering that people want to take away. You don't have to decide what's good for them. You just are available. And people are really only using you to get rid of their suffering. You're not doing it to them. The illusion that a helper is helping is an illusion. All you're doing is being what you are, and they use you to do what they do. It's a much more comfortable role. Let me see where I just went. Yeah.
Hi.
You better call me Ram Dass, because when you say hi, Ram, it's saying hi, God. And some people might think it's a little chutzpah-ish, you know. So. Okay.
Yes.
The observer is merely appreciating the way it is. The self-criticism is judging the way it is. The mind judges, that other spacious awareness merely appreciates the way things are. When you go out in the woods and you look at a pine and an oak and an elm, you just appreciate them the way they are. You don't have to say, I wish the elm were an oak. So you don't judge the trees, you appreciate them. The minute you get near humans, especially yourself, you move into the judging mode. And you get to the point where as you notice yourself judging, you let go into appreciation again. You just keep flipping that a little bit. And you start to appreciate the phenomena as they are, rather than feeling you always have to have an opinion about everything and judge it all the time. And after a while, you begin to notice your own self-criticizing as just another poignant part of nature happening. No, that's like one of my little neurotic schmooze, you know. Ah, there you are judging yourself again. Come on in, relax, it's okay. I mean, it's all right to judge yourself. It's not a terrible thing, it's okay. When you get tired of it, you'll stop. You don't have to make such a big deal about, I got to get rid of it. My God, how do you do? I'm Richard.
Well, I'm somebody getting rid of my judging mind.
See, that's all. Questions? Yes. Ah, how smart. You want it in words, the answer to of why it all began, what we're doing here, why? No? Just why? Yeah. Great. It is simple. It's not in your mind. Your mind can never answer that question. The mind will never be satisfied because the answer to the question why is not a conceptual answer. So the mind is always frustrated about that. It'll keep eternally asking why, and it'll never be satisfied with the answer. You can only be the answer to the question. You can't know the answer. That's the difference between wisdom and knowledge. You can be wise, and you can know knowledge. And that's part of wisdom, not knowledge. And you just have an intuitive sense of why. And yet you don't, and the minute your mind tries to grab it, it can't, because it reduces it. The mind itself distorts it just by trying to ask. Yes? When you get into pain and suffering, how do you have the mercy of God to understand it because it seems so real? In answer to that, I'd like to read you a letter. Some of you may have heard this letter, and it's been published, I think, in a book by Stephen Levine and also by Elizabeth Ross. This is a letter I wrote to a couple whose daughter, 11-year-old daughter, went to play tennis with her friend at the Jewish Community Center, and the two girls were raped and murdered. And I wrote a letter to them. And when I went to write the letter, because they called, people called and asked if I'd write a letter, and the immensity of the pain of what they had gone through was so great. To write the letter, I just had to almost go beyond myself because I couldn't get beyond the pain of it at the moment. And I wrote, "Dear Stephen and Anita, Rachel finished her work on Earth and left the stage in a manner that leaves those of us left behind with a cry of agony in our hearts as the fragile thread of our faith is dealt with so violently. Is anyone strong enough to stay conscious through such teaching as you are receiving? Probably very few, and even they would have only a whisper of equanimity and spacious peace amidst the screaming trumpets of their rage, grief, horror, and desolation. I can't assuage your pain with any words, nor should I, for your pain is Rachel's legacy to you. Not that she or I would inflict such pain by choice, but there it is, and it must burn its purifying way to completion. For something in you dies when you bear the unbearable, and it is only in that dark night of the soul that you are prepared to see as God sees, and to love as God loves. Now is the time to let your grief find expression. No false strength. Now is the time to sit quietly and speak to Rachel and thank her for being with you these few years and encourage her to go on with her work, knowing that you will grow in compassion and wisdom from this experience. In my heart, I know that you and she will meet again and again and recognize the many ways in which you have known each other. And when you meet, you will, in a flash, know what now it is not given you to you to know, why this had to be the way it was. Our rational minds can never understand what has happened, but our hearts, if we can keep them open to God, will find their own intuitive way. Rachel came through you to do her work on earth, which includes her manner of death. Now her soul is free, and the love that you can share with her is invulnerable to the winds of changing time and space. Now, in that letter is the component of that when you have something that dies or there is a death of a dream, you have grief. And that's part of the human condition. And you don't push it away. You honor it and you allow it and you give it plenty of space. At the same moment, you keep cultivating that part of you which is behind that. And you do the spiritual cultivation not to push away the grief, but to, and also, and also, and also. But you don't push it. There is pain in life. And you've got to honor your humanity. I am experiencing myself being more human, more caring, more hurting, more alive than I ever was before. And it feels to me like it's more spiritual truth than it ever was before at the same moment.